Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Guy that I always suspect and still do, he did tell my mom that my stepmom lived longer than my dad did because the killer could hear gurgling noises.
Gary and Stephanie Gillette had many friends. No one that they came across could resist the genuine charm, charisma, and good nature that both exuded. The nature of Gary's business, providing and maintaining drilling mud to the seemingly countless oil rigs surrounding the Corpus Christi area and beyond, had the couple always on the go. Gary was often called away at a moment's notice to manage problems or sales associated with the business, Aquavert drilling fluids, and Stephanie often accompanied him. All the couple's friends were aware of this fact and weren't surprised when plans were broken. It was simply the nature of the business. Of all the people who cared about Gary and Stephanie, and there were plenty, a couple of whom were to see the couple the day before their bodies were found, only one presented himself as worried about their whereabouts enough to call police on Sunday, December 15th, 1985. Oddly, though, he never attempted to first locate the couple through family members or other friends of the couple, many of which he knew well. Gary had been friends with this individual for many years, since both were in high school, in fact, where they met at the Padre Staples Mall in Corpus Christi, where they both worked. He worked full-time as a Nueces County deputy constable in Port Aransas between the months of March and September, and since the remaining months only provided him with reserve status as a deputy constable, he supplemented his income with private investigation, mostly helping local attorneys with initial or light legwork. We'll refer to this individual as the constable from this point forward. Another close friend of Stephanie and Gary, C.P. Coker, said that he also shared in the friendship with Gary and the constable. The men often celebrated holidays together and, in fact, had just spent the previous Thanksgiving together while Stephanie was out of town. The constable knew the oil field, too. He'd worked off and on for refineries and occasionally accompanied Gary on business trips. And though it was heavily frowned upon, or most likely downright prohibited, Gary sometimes rode along with the constable on official police business. C.P. Coker called Gary and the constable very close friends, saying that they had immense respect for each other, and adding that he never knew them to have a falling out. On Friday, December 13th, 1985, while they attended a business Christmas party at the Tramp Steamer Bar, Gary left to attend a separate party at another bar, leaving Stephanie at the Tramp Steamer with other close friends. At the second party, Gary met up with the constable. At some point, Gary and the constable, along with his date for the evening, decided to head back to the Gillette home on Sweetbriar Circle. Gary arrived at the house first, the constable and his date soon after. It wouldn't be long before Stephanie would return home as well. What happened next can only be speculated. However, it is known that Gary and Stephanie Gillette were murdered in their bed as they slept in the early morning hours of Saturday, December 14th, 1985, each struck repeatedly with a hatchet and stabbed multiple times. The constable is also the last known person to see the couple alive and, of course, the individual who alerted police to the couple's home the following day. Though the events in a timeline of that night and early morning are indeed vague, court documents and the witness testimony of the constable's date that night provide some insight into what transpired. At 12:30 a.m., Gary's answering service spoke with both him and the constable, who also used the service. This is the last time the service heard from Gary Gillette. The woman who answered spoke briefly with Gary before handing the phone to the constable. She told police that he repeatedly asked about a woman who he wished to date, who we'll call Rachel for our purposes, and informed the service that he'd be spending the night at the Gillette home. The constable's date that night was admittedly intoxicated, but she did recall one thing in particular. Though it is unknown, it isn't difficult to assume the constable's date that night had gone to bed before the 12:31 a.m. call to the answering service, since he had been inquiring about another woman, Rachel, who he was interested in. Asleep in the bedroom that Gary's daughter Shay occupied when she was at the Gillette home, the constable's date was awoken by him. He said something along the lines of, "There's some bad shit going down, we need to leave." They left the Gillette home, the constable drove his date to her car, and she drove home. He returned to the Gillette home sometime after this, he told police, to retrieve a coat his date had left, adding that nothing at all seemed amiss at the home, and that the Buick Electra, Gary Gillette's prized vehicle that would be found parked on a street 2 days later, was still in the garage when he left. The specific time he claimed to have come back to pick up the coat is unknown, though calls by the constable to the answering service do provide other confirmable timestamps. At 3:45 a.m., the operator of the answering service spoke with the constable for, quote, a long time. She reported that, again, he droned on about his romantic desires for Rachel. This call came from the constable's home, where he told the operator he would remain from that point on. His residence received an incoming call at 5:30 a.m. That call went unanswered. The answering service operator answered, and the caller hung up. As previously mentioned, Gary's Buick Electra would be found 2 days later, parked in front of a residence a little less than 2.5 miles from the Gillette home. This fact alone is hardly telling. In the early morning hours of that Saturday, though, a resident of the house in which the vehicle sat in front observed it there at approximately 2:30 a.m. That observer was none other than the brother of the woman, Rachel, who the constable had expressed his desires for to the answering service operator over and over. A fingerprint had also been lifted from the wiped-down vehicle, sitting, court documents say, on top of a dried water stain on the inside of the right passenger side window. A fingerprint expert determined the print to be recent in origin, and the print determined to belong to the constable. Upon arriving at the scene the day Gary and Stephanie's bodies were discovered, unaware of what was happening, Gary's former wife, Debbie, approached the only familiar face she saw, the constable. Debbie knew the constable through his friendship with her ex-husband. He only ever visited the home she and Gary shared while they were married twice. Gary's daughters, it seems, never even laid eyes on the man once.
The one that found them was supposed to be my dad's best friend. Well, my mom, you know, she saw him and she recognized him. I didn't. I didn't even know who that guy was, you know. And when I told my mom, I was all, who the hell was that, you know? And she said, well, that guy is like one of your dad's best friends. Anyway, he told my mom, you know, that they were gone and that he had been trying to get a hold of my dad and was, you know, curious as to why he wasn't able to get a hold of them. So he came over. For him to be friends with my dad, as long as my mom said he had, I had no idea who he was when we walked up there.
Honestly, I remember a lot of my dad's friends, and I cannot for the life of me remember him being around. If he was, then it had to have only been maybe once or twice where it wasn't really significant, but I don't remember him being around.
Gary's oldest daughter, Shay, who had arrived at the scene with her mother, was indescribably distraught and overwhelmed by the jam-packed cul-de-sac that was completely blocked by droves of police vehicles, the coroner van, the local television and newspaper media, neighbors who'd come out of their homes to observe, and passers-by who stopped to quench their curiosity. However, she does recall seeing the constable there.
He was a constable in Port Aransas for a while, which is off Padre Island. You know, I mean, so I know he's seen things like that before. So I can't say that he was in shock. He might have been in shock, you know, from that being one of his friends.
But,
I mean, he had no emotion whatsoever. He wouldn't cry in. He didn't try to console either my mom or myself. He just stood there the whole time. And I just couldn't believe that he was so blasé about it. But, you know, you just get a vibe from people. And to me, he was just cold and emotionless. That was the impression I got. Everything, the way he acted and didn't act, yeah, that's how I felt.
After taking a statement from the constable, he was given a polygraph test, which he passed. Investigators, though, were skeptical about the results, according to Gary's brother, Mike.
And he took a lie detector test, and you know, every time they'd ask him a specific question, he'd cough. So he knew what he was doing.
Gary and Stephanie Gillette's joint funerals weren't without incident involving the constable. A close family member of Stephanie gave a statement to police describing a bizarre exchange with him as he arrived there. When approached at the funeral by this individual and Gary's brother, the constable told them that he and a girlfriend were there, that Stephanie and Gary began arguing when Stephanie arrived home a short time after Gary, the constable, and his date arrived. He told them that he and his date didn't have to put up with that, so they left, the constable returning to retrieve his date's coat later on, noticing nothing unusual. He said he couldn't discuss the case beyond that, as he was aiding police in their investigation, but he could tell them more later. When the funerals were coming to an end, Stephanie's family member once again approached the constable, who was standing in the hallway of the funeral home, looking out the window. He stood next to the constable and commented on the rain. The constable turned to him suddenly, grabbed his shirt in a way which he describes as violently, shivered, and gritted his teeth. The family member just looked at him, presumably shocked, and the constable let go after a few seconds. Gary's daughter, Shay, recalls the constable's demeanor at the funeral.
I remember him being a pallbearer, and the funeral was like a blur to me because, you know, there was the funeral home was packed. I mean, it was standing room only, pretty much. I remember walking out and seeing carrying one of the coffins, or he was one of the pallbearers. You know, I got that same cold, distant feeling from him. He had no emotion on his face or anything.
Gary's former wife, Debbie, also had a strange exchange with the constable there.
And he came up to me at the funeral home and he's like, do you hate me? I'm like, why the hell would I hate you? And he goes, well, I don't know. I just want to know if you hate me. And I'm like, I don't have any reason to hate you. And left it at that, and I walked away from him.
Debbie, who assumed he had information unknown to the public about Stephanie and Gary's slayings because of his remarks to Gary's brother and Stephanie's family member, later called the constable to ask questions. The constable did offer Debbie a chilling account.
So I called him, and he's like, but let me just tell you this. Stephanie did live longer because the murderer heard gurgling noises and went back to finish her off. And at the time, I'm like, oh, wow. I didn't even think. I didn't even let that absorb in my head. oh my God, how did you know that? How did you know that? And so I told my dad, I told the police this. I gave a police report. I told them everything I knew. And to this day, I've never had any dealings with him since then.
Corpus Christi homicide detectives believed the constable's statements to them contained many inconsistencies and, of course, became aware of what he said to Debbie on the phone. According to court documents, the constable also told another individual what he had told Debbie. In May of 1986, the Corpus Christi Caller Times released an article in which police made this awareness known, though ambiguously, and told the newspaper that they sought to step up the investigation. Days after the article saw print, a warrant was issued for the arrest of the constable, charging him with the murders of Gary and Stephanie Gillette. The complaint against him included what he told the individual about Stephanie Gillette being alive after the first attack, and attacked again later. It noted that the constable offered this information as a correction when the individual paraphrased what the medical examiner had told the press about the murders, that both victims' deaths were immediate. Lieutenant Eddie Garza of the Corpus Christi Police listed on the complaint that it was the opinion of the department that only the killer would have had a belief that Stephanie had lived for several hours after the attack. The warrant affidavit also included where Gary's Buick Electra had been abandoned in front of the home of a love interest of the constable and the fingerprint belonging to the constable on the window of the wiped-down vehicle. The constable turned himself in to police, but maintained his innocence in the killings. He was subsequently suspended as a deputy constable without pay. He lawyered up, of course. Douglas Tinker wasn't just any other attorney. Tinker was a former prosecutor turned private practice attorney, switching his capabilities to defense, which is a relatively common thing for district attorneys to do. By 1985, Douglas Tinker had already made quite a name for himself. His cases were not only high profile, he often represented folks that would be seemingly less than desirable to many attorneys. Over the course of his career, Tinker's clients have included a broad spectrum of defendants, from murderers and a police lieutenant accused of playing a role in conspiracy to commit armed robbery, to survivors of the Waco Branch Davidian compound disaster, and Yolanda Saldivar, who was convicted of the murder of superstar Selena Quintanilla. The press and colleagues referred to him as the defender of the indefensible and the greatest trial lawyer of our time. When brought up in any given conversation between locals, the phrase, "he could get the devil off," would almost certainly be said about Tinker at some point. Douglas Tinker had collected letters from 35 of the constable's friends, fellow law enforcement officers, city officials, and other acquaintances showing support for the constable's claims of innocence and demanding a reduction of the steep $200,000 bond that had been set by the courts. The constable's personal physician for nearly 10 years told the court via letter, quote, "Nothing in his past medical history would lead me to suspect any violent personality traits," end quote. Tinker himself guaranteed the constable would make good on his bond and not flee prosecution, and on June 6, 1986, the bond was reduced to $20,000. The constable made that bond and was released.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
A warrant to search the constable's home had been carried out after his arrest. While it is unknown exactly what the search turned up, Family members of Gary and Stephanie Gillette have been told that a book titled They Call Me the Catch Me Killer was one item that caught not only the attention of investigators, but also District Attorney Bill May. The book is written by Robert John Erler, a rookie patrol officer for the Hollywood, Florida Police Department, who murdered a 12-year-old girl and attempted to murder her mother, shooting both in the face and neck 5 times each. There is a lot more to the book than what is relevant here, or at least more than what is relevant to the information outside of the police file on Gary and Stephanie Gillette. However, there are some points in particular that might have been what caught the eye of detectives. In the investigation into the murders, after the surviving victim was able to give police an account of what happened, Erler, deemed super cop by his peers, was determined to be the last person to see the victims alive. He also found the girl's body, secured that scene, and assisted with the investigation. Erler had already disturbed or confused the scene of the actual shootings by moving the girl's body to a separate location, not to mention calling the police prior to the mother and daughter being found, claiming 3 victims. When Erler finally stopped proclaiming his innocence and came clean, after he'd been in prison for some time, he contends that something in him just went off. He just snapped. It wouldn't be until October 1987, almost 2 years after the violent and brutal slayings of Gary and Stephanie Gillette, that movement ceased on the case against the constable. Because the district attorney felt that they could not provide proof to a jury beyond reasonable doubt, the charges were dropped. District Attorney Bill May told the Corpus Christi Caller-Times that there is no statute of limitations for murder, and that the investigation into the murders would continue. It's said that Bill May kept the book by Robert John Erler on a bookshelf in his office. If that is indeed the case, perhaps it sat as a constant reminder to him that the Gillette case remained unresolved. The constable's attorney, Douglas Tinker, told the Caller-Times that his client was willing to aid police in their efforts. The reporter asked the high-profile defender if he had an idea of who the perpetrator of the depraved and senseless murders was, to which he replied, "The truth is, we do." Tinker wouldn't identify just who the possible person of interest was, telling the reporter that the suspicions were based on theory. The constable told the papers that his faith in the justice system had dwindled, that his perception of that system was that individuals are, quote, guilty until proven innocent, end quote. He claims that he was told a position as a deputy constable was again available for him, but he was never reinstated. The families of both Stephanie and Gary Gillette were left in limbo as the case garnered less and less police activity and involvement for the next 30 years. It wasn't long after the murders that DNA technology became available to law enforcement agencies nationwide, and it remains unclear if or in what capacity evidential items taken from the Gillette home and Gary's Buick were tested. Considering factors such as population and geography, it was probable that, at some point, Gary's daughters would someday come face to face with the only individual ever publicly known as a suspect in the murders of their father and stepmother. And 2 of them did, the interactions seemingly as awkward as those involving the constable and other family members years before.
So the weird thing is as, you know, whenever I was married and my ex-husband and I had gone out to have a drink, and it just so happened that one of the places my dad used to frequent was open. And so we went in there, and it was kind of weird because where all the pool tables were, they have these old pictures up, and my dad was in almost every one of them. And I thought that was kind of neat. So my ex-husband and I played pool, sat down, had a drink, and I heard the bartender say the name. I was like, oh my gosh, I think that's him. Well, then the waitress came over to serve our drink. And I asked her who that man at the bar was. She said, that's I don't know where I got the courage, but I was like, I'm going to go introduce myself. Because I thought, you know, if he didn't have anything to do with it, since he was truly the only suspect back then I would expect him to, you know, maybe be a little nervous, but, hey, how are you doing? You know, I'm really sorry about what happened to your dad and stepmom. I had nothing to do with it. You know, that would have been my expected reaction from him. However, I went up and tapped him on the shoulder, and he turned back towards me, and he said yes. And I said, "Are you?" And he said yes. And he goes, and I said, "Well, I'm Christy Gillette. I'm Gary's middle daughter. How are you doing?" And his face seriously turned like ghost white. And he didn't really have much to say, and I don't remember everything that he said, but it was very minimal. Like, we didn't speak for very long, and so I kind of just walked off. So it was just kind of a weird interaction.
I want to say maybe 12, 13 years ago, I was at Sam's, and I was grocery shopping, and he walked in. And mind you, I have not seen this man since I was 8 years old. And the minute he walked in, I looked at him, and I knew who he was, and he knew who I was. And he just turned white, like he had seen a ghost. I kept walking, and I thought to myself, you know, do not let this moment pass you by. And I turned around, and I walked up to him, and I'm like, "Hi, I'm Candace." And he was like, "I know." And I just started talking to him, and he told me, he was like, "There's so much that I cannot say, because I will be next." And I just looked at him, and I'm like, "You are my dad's friend. How could you know and not say anything?" You could tell he was extremely uncomfortable. I was kind of scared because I'm like, "Oh my God, you know, what if I'm stirring up something? What if he does like try to come after me?" I mean, I was scared. And so I kind of just took a step back and just let it go. And I was like, "Well, it was nice seeing you."
Though she never physically came across the constable, Gary's other daughter came into contact with someone who claims they did. The source of the claims not only came into contact with her in a way that seems like fate intervened, but was also reliable.
After I graduated from paralegal school, I did my internship with a private investigator. She worked with a juvenile judge. They have the same office. And she told me she knew everything about my dad's case, but she was also good friends with the female cop. And the female cop, she actually came into the office one day to talk to me about it. She was off duty one night and at a bar, and she just happened to sit down at the bar right next to He was drunk on his ass, and he commenced to tell her how he killed two people and got away with it.
It isn't clear how the constable and his attorney explained away the less than wide open window of time in which another individual or individuals could have entered the Gillette home, killed the couple using two weapons, hid the hatchet between the mattress and box springs of the bed in which the constable's date and, presumably he, had been sleeping, cleaned and returned the second murder weapon, the chef's knife, to the kitchen in its proper place, driven Gary Gillette's prized Buick Electra to a location almost 2.5 miles away, wiping it clean, except for a lone fingerprint, returned to the Gillette home and pulled Gary and Stephanie's bodies off the bed, placing or dropping them onto the floor next to it, and locked the house up tight upon their exit, all between the constable's final time to leave the home after returning to retrieve his date's coat and sun up, which would have begun in the minutes just before 7 a.m. Former Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office homicide detective Danny Smith spoke with us about the Gillette case.
There was a very, very wise and experienced homicide detective that put on one of our schools, and he had a tremendous amount of experience. One of the things that he used to say is, you brush aside the impossible and push aside the improbable, and usually what you've got left is what you're really looking at. And the reason I say that is, a lot of times, you know, you get off into the weeds with these different conspiracies, but most murders are usually pretty simple and basic, unless you're talking about a serial killer, you know, that type of a case. But most cases are a little bit easier to understand and at least figure out. You know, you might not have enough evidence to prosecute, but I would bet my bottom dollar that everyone looking at this case is still looking at as the prime suspect. It'd be hard to come off of him. It really would. And it doesn't really matter what his demeanor was like as a constable and how polite he was most of the time or whatever. When someone snaps, they're not the same person that they are, you know, 98% of the time that other people see them. You know, the one thing, I'll tell you what bothers me about the hatchet is that why would a guy, especially someone who had law enforcement experience, put a hatchet under the bed he sleeps in? to me, that's like the stupidest thing a guy could do, you know, to conceal the murder weapon where you were sleeping, you know, unless you're just not thinking anyone's ever going to put you at that house and you have no intention of ever admitting to being there that night. But it's still an odd thing as opposed to taking both weapons and disposing of them or leaving them both in the same place. So basically, I think that the purse and the jewelry missing, there's a strong likelihood that that coincides with also the car being removed and basically wanting to stage, make the case look like, you know, it was a robbery murder. Well, that might have played out okay had not spent the night there and left in the middle of the night. I mean, that pretty much sealed the deal for me, you know. You have a hard time getting past that. The reason a person would admit to going back to a house is in order or in fear of that someone will put him being at that house, a neighbor sees him or anything else. He needs to be able to justify why he went back there. People definitely try to alter crime scenes when they are going to be someone who is highly suspected. You know, in a stranger murder, they could care less about, you know, trying to alter a crime scene per se, unless, you know, I mean, there are organized killers that they want to throw the police off or, you know, maybe it's even part of their game. But as far as, you know, your average stranger murderer, they're far less concerned about what the police read into the crime scene as far as motive and all of that. They could care less. But, you know, someone that's related to the people or closely associated to the victims, they've got a real reason to try to disguise the crime scene, to try to make it look like something that it wasn't. That's clearly why the prosecutors did not go forward. I mean, they didn't say that they believe that he did not kill them. They said that they don't have enough evidence to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that he did kill them. So my sense of the matter is just that. It's a circumstantial case. Clearly it is. It's circumstantial. You know, you don't have an eyewitness to the case. So you basically have physical evidence and whatever motive you can, you know, determine. Not that motive is necessary to prosecute, but it helps to at least be able to suggest a possible motive. But that's the thing here. I mean, you don't see him hauling in anyone else and going down another path. It's like the OJ thing. You know, no one's out there beating the bushes thinking that there might be a real killer out there. You know, everyone knows OJ did it, right?
Danny also spoke of the frustration that detectives face when they are unable to solve a case and how those cases can haunt them.
I promise you this, it's tough for the investigators. And I'm speaking from experience. There's cases while we're sitting here having this conversation that are bouncing around in my head. The unsolved cases haunt you, and they're horrible. It's a terrible thing to have to live with because you feel like you failed. You always want to go back and try again. And of course, you know, at some point you just can't.
Roy Gardner, former Corpus Christi homicide detective, and who was at the scene the day Stephanie and Gary were found, shared his thoughts with us as well.
It was sad to see the scene of the way he died. When you see something like that, you definitely feel, you know, obligation to want to find out who did it and get it solved. And there's more frustration when you kind of find out who did it, but then you can't get him convicted, you know. I can see somebody being in a position where they might, you know, snap for a moment and do something terrible like that. But to live with it all those years and know that you did it, know that there's family members out there hoping for closure, the fear of, you know, going to prison, I guess, keeps some people from doing anything. I wouldn't be surprised, though. Sometimes you have people like that, they'll paint themselves as a victim also. Yeah, sometimes they'll say, hey, you know, I was falsely accused, you know, and I've had to live and deal with it all these years. And they'll try to paint themselves as a victim or something, you know. And then, you know, you get into the religion, right? If you're a religious person, because, you know, if he is, he knows, and sooner or later, I mean, he may get away with it here, but sooner or later, he's going to have to answer to somebody. You know, there's so much there at the scene that I'm just wondering if that was really, you know, preserved and still there. You know, and I would have thought that with the new technology and all of everything, DNA, you know, that it should have helped a lot trying to identify whether or not this guy is the actual killer. But I understand there's a tremendous amount of paperwork. But I do know that the two guys that worked on it later, they were known for documenting a lot of stuff. And they did a lot of work on it. So if they wrote supplementary reports on every single thing they did, then I can see that there's a large paper trail.
It's the families of the victims who bear the brunt of the uncertainty, anguish, and often the fear associated with unsolved cases. And the ripple effect can be felt generations down the line, even to those who never knew the victim. That's next time on Gone Cold Podcast. If you have any information on the murders of Mary Stephanie and Gary Jean Gillette, please contact the Corpus Christi Police Department at 361-886-2840. We'd like to extend a huge thank you to Shay, Christy, Candace, Debbie, and Mike for their contributions to this episode. A huge thank you to Vaughn as well, who brought the case to our attention and whose countless hours of research seeking to expose Stephanie and Gary's killer is inspiring. We'd like to thank former Corpus Christi homicide detective and current private investigator Roy Gardner for his help as well. We'd also like to thank Danny Smith, retired Los Angeles County homicide detective and current writer of the Dickie Floyd detective novel series, for his contribution. Visit our Facebook and Twitter pages for your chance to win a copy of Danny's incredible first novel, A Good Bunch of Men, signed and personalized by him as a grand prize, and five runners-up will also win a Kindle copy of the book. That's how nice a guy Danny is. We'd like to extend a huge thank you to our friend and master researcher, Kim, for her help with gathering information for the Gillette case, and to Marguerite for her advice, too. The Corpus Christi Caller Times and the book by Joseph A. Varon called The Catch Me Killer were used as sources for this episode. Varon's book, not to be confused with Robert Erler's They Call Me the Catch Me Killer. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are several varying donation levels to choose from, with perks to go along with each, including ad-free listening at all levels. Donations help us cover the cost of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. Another great way to support the show is to leave a rating and review on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to the show. It helps guide more folks our way. And if you're interested in all things true crime, be sure to check out thetruecrimefiles.com, where you'll find well-presented cases, many unknown or ignored by the media, as well as book reviews, podcast reviews, and guest posts. The True Crime Files is our go-to spot on the web, and it's amazing for learning about cases you might not be aware of otherwise. Thanks for listening, y'all.